The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
My next guest began his career with a legal row over a chocolate eclair, but it's certainly far from chocolate eclairs that he deals with now. Paul Tweed, libel lawyer to the stars, is with me in studio to talk about his new book, which is called From Hollywood to Hollywood, subtitled My Life as an International Libel Lawyer to the Rich and Famous. Paul, good morning and welcome.
Yeah, good morning, Pat.
Now, I want to go back to the very beginning of your book, where you talk about a famous, well, not famous, to the greater world, but within your own family, a famous case involving your mother and father.
Absolutely. This goes way back to 1953, before I was born, I would hasten to add. My mother, unknown to me until she was very close to ending her years, had a slander case against an aunt of my father's. And my mother and father were engaged. This aunt had agreed to pay for a deposit on the house, a grand sum of £250.
Which, a lot of money in those days.
Exactly. Probably still a lot of money to some people now. But anyway, as a result of other relatives taking a dislike to my mother and her father, on the basis that they were coming from a working class background, they started basically to badmouth my mother's father in particular, and persuaded the aunt to withdraw the offer of the deposit. The contracts had been signed. The couple were in an absolutely horrendous position. They managed to get themselves out of it. But my mother, who was working as a legal secretary at the time, was persuaded by her employer to take action against the aunt. And she sued her and her father sued the aunt for slander, and managed to win £250, which there was significance, obviously, in that award. The judge just decided that they were being very badly treated, and so was the start of sort of what I would regard as sort of prescient foresight for my own career.
But here you had a situation where they presumably lost the house because they extracted themselves from the first contract.
They had to rent a house for a number of years after that, and until they could eventually afford to put a deposit down.
But you wonder, therefore, if that appetite for litigation is in the DNA.
I do wonder that, Pat, even though, as I say, I didn't know until, you know, a number of years later. My mother never discussed it, never mentioned it, but she was very keen for me to do law, and I assumed it was because she had worked as a legal secretary and she was following that, and I didn't know what I wanted to do in those days, so I just followed.
Perhaps she knew it was a nice little earner.
Perhaps. You never know.
What about the aunt? I mean, did you get to meet the aunt? Were cordial relations re-established?
They were, incredibly. Over the years, we were brought down to Ballymoney to meet with her on a fairly regular basis. And this was all unknown to me. I didn't know what had happened before, but presumably they'd made up and kissed and whatever. That was sort of regarded as family history.
Family history.
And everyone moved on.
Disreputable family history.
Yeah.
Now, the chocolate eclair, tell us about that.
Well, this was 1986, and Bob McCartney and Des Bowell were the two sort of leading civil and criminal senior counsel of their day. And another lawyer, we learned later, had a bit of a grudge against him and gave a story to the Sunday World newspaper to the effect that they both were fighting over a chocolate eclair in a Hollywood, County Down, cake shop. And as a result, the Sunday World did a story ridiculing both men. And, you know, at that level, you've really got to maintain your integrity. And most people, you know, were thinking, look, this is trivial, waste of time, why are they bothering?
But their reputations,
and, you know, particularly where people were making fun of them over the whole incident. So anyway, they sued, and it was a vitriolic case would be a gross understatement, but it was fought tooth and nail for over a week before a Belfast jury. Seven individuals from a working class background heard the case, heard McCartney's evidence in particular. I mean, he was brought up in a Shankill Road, big family, was able to relate to the jury, to explain, look, he's earned every penny that's ever come to him. And they found in their favour and awarded him £50,000 each. £50,000 each, a lot of money today, but an awful lot of money in 1986.
Huge amount of money over a chocolate eclair.
Exactly.
Now your own rise to prominence revolves around two people whose names we know well, and that is Eastwood and McGuigan.
Yes.
Is that how you got your start in the big time, as it were?
The cream bun case sort of gave me a bit of an adrenaline push. The Eastwood case was something on a different stratosphere. Everyone thought Barry McGuigan, and you know, he was very, very popular at the time. Barney Eastwood, the wealthy boxing promoter, businessman. So the odds were stacked against Eastwood to start with. But when Barry McGuigan, you know, accused Eastwood of putting him to the ring injured, Eastwood had no choice. I mean, he believed no choice but to take him on and get the record set straight. So Barney and I toured the United States, speaking to referees, fight officials, former sparring partners, even Mike Sheminsky, who was then the physio to the New York Lakers basketball team. And we were absolutely satisfied. Barney and I were satisfied. Look, you know, this case, we're going to win this case. And we assumed at that stage, at least I did, that it would settle. It was 99.9% of my cases settle over the last 40 years. They've always settled. Very few, I always regard as a failure if a client has to go into the witness box. This case, unfortunately, wasn't going to settle because Mr. McGuigan and his lawyer decided they were going to fight it. And at the opening, as I mentioned in the book, you know, we went in with, you know, full confidence. But they were, because they were making the allegation and were justifying, attempting to justify what they said, they went first. And their first witness turned out to be a doctor we couldn't find. It was quite mysterious. We tried all around the states in LA to try and track this doctor down. We couldn't find him anywhere. And he gave evidence which was contrary to our case, if I could put it that way. And so started a 5.5 week roller coaster.
Oh my goodness.
And it was one.
I'm looking, you know, thinking from the litigant's point of view, the cash register, ching, ching, ching.
No, unless you had the financial backup that Eastwood had, you couldn't even remotely consider it. I wouldn't let any client near the courts. And I mean, I can come on to that later in terms of the actual cost today by comparison. But this was the biggest case probably I've ever been involved in. Even all like the celebrities and different people I've acted for, the entrepreneurs, nothing will match that Eastwood case for the adrenaline. But it was up and down. They called witnesses, we called witnesses. We had people from the boxing world, Harry Carpenter, a well-known boxing commentator, different people came in. It was full of just drama.
And this was before a jury?
Before a jury, again, seven persons in Belfast.
So you never know. I mean, this is, the jury retires and you are there on tenterhooks. You don't know which way it's going to go.
Totally. I mean, right up until about a week before, into week four, a judge who was a neighbour of mine came across and said, look, you're very young. You're putting your reputation on the line. You can't possibly win this case. The odds are stacked against you. Everyone believes that, you know, Barry's going to win. And I sort of said to myself, well, what am I meant to do? We're over four weeks in. There's not exactly a lot of options here, but I was still supremely confident.
So to borrow a phrase, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Exactly, exactly. And particularly where, you know, you were in and there was no way of getting out of a case of that nature unless it was a humiliating climb down.
And what was Barney Eastwood's attitude to this? I mean, he's looking at the bills racking up.
He was utterly confident, absolutely. He was very unusual for a client because he loved the witness box. It was like a game of golf for him. He loved the excitement, the adrenaline drive of being in the witness box. And he was the only client I've ever had that I had great difficulty keeping out of the witness box and trying to persuade him to settle. And, you know, and as a result, lots of cases settled because everyone knew he was going to go in regardless.
What was the impact of that case then on your career?
Well, you know, the record award of 450,000 was, you know, a record for Ireland at that stage, as I understand the position. And for me, I thought no other case is going to match it. At that stage, I'd been doing basically insurance defence cases, personal injury cases. They just didn't have the buzz. And so as a result of, when, for instance, one of the witnesses was a Philadelphia-based lawyer, Jimmy Binns. So he came to me for a case here in Ireland, and he acted for a number of well-known people, although I didn't get any of his clients as such. But again, I thought, right, the United States. So then I had Liam Neeson, and then I had a number of fairly well-known Irish musicians, different things. And then the big moment came in 2006, Britney Spears. Internet was really starting to take off before social media, and she came. The National Enquirer had made a fundamental mistake. They'd never apologised in their 70 or 80 year history up to this point, but they opened a European edition. And I don't think
this
they thought
is just
it through.
Because of the freedom of speech situation in the US Constitution, it's very hard, no matter what someone says about you, it's very hard to sue successfully in the United States.
Absolutely. You've got to show actual malice under the First Amendment, just almost total protection. So as a result, most of them had to take it in the chin out there. And so basically, whenever her case came along, the National Enquirer suddenly raised, oops, we have exposed ourselves to Irish and European data protection, privacy and defamation laws. And we got the case settled relatively quickly and they did their first apology. So I thought, right, okay, how are we going to do this? I mean, how do I get an apology from Ireland to LA? We put it just back down the web the same way it had come up to me, and I watched in about 7 seconds. It went right across from Ireland, across Europe, right to Far East, Australia, and right into LA. And I was absolutely transfixed.
You were the lawyer who persuaded the National Enquirer to apologise for the very first time.
Correct. And we got that there. And then after that, the celebrities came in, the Hollywood A-listers came in, and I can name drop for Ireland.
Please don't let
me do it, because my wife will be cringing in the background listening to this. I've been warned, you don't do it. But you know, all these clients, I mean, it doesn't matter whether I'm acting for a taxi driver at Dublin Airport or whether I'm acting for one of the big Hollywood A-listers. It doesn't matter. Their problems are very similar, and it's reputation. And most people don't like lawyers. I don't like lawyers myself, to be honest with you. You know, you get the cost. And I compare myself to a dentist. You only come to me if you're in pain. And you see, once I've done the treatment, most people want to get away. Simple as that. But in terms of the actual, if you are left, I mean, Louis Walsh, for instance, was absolutely traumatised by the attack, and is a totally fabricated story. And, you know, he will tell you himself that he's never gone through anything like the trauma. And it's cases like that that you cannot ignore. There's got to be some remedy. And now that we're moving on to the era of the social media platforms, or I should say past the era of social media platforms, under generative AI, etc., we're going into a completely different
world. You believe that
world.
The current law is completely insufficient to cope with the new era in which we live.
Total waste of time. Far too slow. The court of public opinion is streets ahead of the court of law. And the court of public opinion, you do not get an opportunity to cross-examine your accuser. You don't get an opportunity to get to set your case out clearly in a way that people can understand it, and all the pertinent points are there. I mean, Prince Andrew was a case in point in the Newsnight interview. I mean, you advised him
not to do it.
Advised him would be an understatement. But anyway, the rest is history. But, you know, to get an opportunity before the courts, that gives you, both sides, the opportunity for everything to be considered. In the court of a public opinion, it's gone. Once the horse is bolted, that's it.
Now, you would recommend that they are publishers rather than they describe themselves as platforms, yes, and that they should be treated as publishers. But even if you were to treat them the same way as you treat a newspaper, it takes too much time to, as you say, get redress. So what is the law that would stop them in their tracks? Is it the ability to take stuff down within hours rather than weeks or months?
Absolutely. They must have algorithms. And if they don't have algorithms, they've got enough money behind them to invent them and get them put in place where if something come up, warning signs come up, whether, you know, it's a naked body, whether it's somebody saying something about a particular issue, which is well known, they should be able to go in and either stop it, suspend it until they can check it out or whatever. The same way as a newspaper. You know, if a newspaper publishes a reader's letter, that letter has to be checked and vetted in the same way that an article would do. So why should the social media platforms, who have been taking all the advertising from the traditional media, why should they be treated any differently? They are making all the money. They're putting the lights out of the print media completely here. Although I'll come back to that in a moment if I may. There's an important point to be made there. And they're just regurgitating us either. Disinformation, misinformation, anything can go out there, as well as serving a very good, useful social purpose. I mean, I don't want to take that away from them. But you can't earn the money that they're earning without some degree of accountability.
Now, you wanted to say something about print media and how they're being gobbled up by devoured.
We're now in a position where you cannot believe most of what is out there, whether it's coming from bots, whether it's coming from traditional platforms, because they're now interfering with the platforms, with what's out there. Even the traditional, whether it's News Talk, whether it's the Irish Times, they are now exposed to having their reports either tampered with or misquoted. The print media, I think it's going to be a bit like the fax machine. It might be the only safe way of getting the truth.
Yeah.
And because it's in permanent form, it's subject to regulation, and it's heavily legal and edited. And I think I just wouldn't rule out print media making a comeback here. It may be like the old LPs, you know, coming back in here.
Vinyl is back. And print is back, perhaps. Now, one of the things you talk about is all these high-profile clients you have, celebrities, and you don't want to name drop. But you talk about, in a chapter which references George Best, is there an incompatibility between fame and celebrity and privacy?
The big difficulty is you can't, and as Princess Diana was a prime example, you can't have both ways. You know, you've got to accept, if you put your head above the parapet, we all start life with a very big circle of privacy. That's our sphere of protection. Yeah. The more we step outside that sphere and put our head above the parapet, whether it's in the media, whether it's at public events or whatever, the smaller that sphere becomes. But even the most high-profile celebrity, whether it's Beyoncé or Sylvester Stallone or whatever, they still have a sphere of privacy. It's just a very small one. And I say to all of them, and particularly in terms of if they've got children, to make sure that they stay within that, however small the circle is. Once you step outside it, it's open season. But if you stay within it, you've got a chance of at least protecting some degree of privacy for your private life or your family's private life.
So people who, for example, exploit their children in photographic imagery, and I mean just simply, here am I with my lovely, beautiful baby boy or baby girl, and then later on the press, the paps, for example, have a go at them, and they complain about that. And the paps will say, hang on, you put them out there.
Yep. You cannot be selective. You've got to make your mind up. And again, those common scenarios are red carpet events, you know, where the celebrities come out and quite often they bring their kids with them. Now, very few of them do it now, as you'll notice. Yeah. But, you know, that was a major problem for us because, I mean, the media, quite understandably, were saying, look, hold on, you know, you're getting publicity. You've decided to bring your children into the public arena for your purposes, whatever they may be, or for their enjoyment. But you have made that decision. You can't suddenly decide, oh, look, I'm having a holiday in St. Bart's. I'm really humpy that you're, you know, you're photographing my children with me. You cannot do that. Yeah. Once you step outside that sphere, you
Have
no
the
protection.
Royals have their own protocols. They offer the pictures in a window, for example, on the ski slopes or whatever. They offer the pictures. And then there's a kind of an agreement with the British, at least, that they will go away and leave them be.
Exactly. And that was a very a pertinent point that you made there. It's with the UK media, they've got an arrangement, but not so with the French media or some of the, you know, the overseas tabloids.
Now, George Best maintained that he was the man who put sport, moved it from the back pages to the front pages.
Yeah.
That was true.
No, absolutely. And in doing that, unfortunately for him, he wasn't living in the era of David Beckham. So even though they shared the same number, even though they both played in the United States, even though they both played for Manchester United, their fortunes were as diverse as you could possibly imagine. George was a forerunner. He had to stick to Cookstown sausages, whereas Beckham has got everything, the world at his feet.
Well, of course, Beckham has a good manager in his missus.
Yeah, well, that may be the case, exactly. But he's also living in the era of the brand. And that era has only really come to the fore in the last sort of 5 years or so.
Now, you mentioned loads of people that you would consort with in professional terms, like people like Prince Andrew, Elton John, and so on and so forth. And of all the cases you mention, are there cases that you can't mention because you lost?
No, the cases I can't mention are the ones where there's client confidentiality. Yeah. I've got, I mean, probably my best cases, unfortunately, I cannot discuss because in most of these cases, the client wants a result, but they want it put away. They want that, the whole scenario over. And in the era of the internet, if I were to even to recount any of those cases, even if the client allowed me to, I would be advising them not to allow me to do that because it would not be in their interest. The cases I talk about are cases already in the public domain or they're cases that, you know, are subject of court proceedings and we can talk about them. But people can learn from what, you know, it's normally the A-lister, only the A-lister's got the financial, you know, backbone to basically take these cases. But they are setting precedent for the ordinary man in the street to take advantage of at some point in the future if he needs to.
The most unusual cases, I mean, dog smuggling into Australia?
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the day, it was an issue. We'd put it this way, it was supposed to be important enough that it was front page of most of the UK tabloids anyway. So, you know, if it's important enough for the front pages, it has to be
Johnny
important.
This is Johnny Depp and Amber Heard,
What,
in your view, would be the most unusual litigation you've had to...
Well, most of the problems are very, very similar. I mean, we have probably been in every scenario you could manage, you know, you could imagine in terms of a circumstance. But the actual legal issue, the cause from my point of view, it goes down to maybe about 6 or 7 key points that affect different people, whether it's a breach of their privacy, whether it's, you know, misinformation about them. I mean, some of the problems we're getting at the moment in the AI bots are putting in, we'll use the two words, money laundering. And if those go out and they start appearing in some, you know, Far Eastern newspaper picks it up and you have an account with one of the major banks here, they do their Googling of you before, not only before they open your account, but when your account's open. And if they see those two words, they'll suspend your account.
Okay.
And you suddenly, and you're saying, look, this is just rubbish. This is disinformation somebody put out. Doesn't matter. Unless you can satisfy them, that is disinformation, you've got a problem. So we're getting a lot of cases like that. But, you know, there's some of the stuff that, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's cream buns or chihuahuas or whatever it might be. You know, there's a core issue behind it all. It's down to somebody's reputation. And nowadays, the reputation is more important even for the brand. If you're a high-profile celebrity, your reputation is damaged, the value, the financial value of your brand can just go down like a falling blade.
So even if most people don't believe the particular story that's published, it still may be damaging in some territory somewhere in the world. And I was going to ask you that. How do they keep track of maybe everything is kosher in Europe and in the United States, but in Thailand they're being libeled? Yeah.
Well, most of the very high-profile people will have, you know, agents, publicists, etc., who will keep an eye on online coverage. They can't possibly cover it all. And more importantly, they can't possibly take action in certain jurisdictions because, one, there's maybe no libel law. Two, it's a scenario where even if they get it taken down, say, to use your example, Thailand, it's still going to be there in France, it's still going to be there in Ireland. And, you know, we have a number of cases going at the moment against the platforms and the search engines and whatever.
And do you need a famous victory there to establish a point of principle?
If it's a defamation case and you can get a result, normally that result can be disseminated around the world, which will negate any damage you've got. But if it's a lower profile situation or you haven't got it into court, you are faced with the problem. And the likes of, whether it's Google, Meta, X, any of them, they'll say, look, we'll comply with any court order you get. If you get a court order, we will comply with it. And they do. But so I get a court order in Ireland, but that's no use to me in the United States. That's no use to me in Sweden. That's no use to me in France. They expect us to go to every single jurisdiction at a cost, maybe it could be anything from 5,000 to 100,000 euros.
Yeah.
To get that, or even if they consent, even if they don't oppose or whatever, you've got to do that. Who can afford to do that? And who has actually got the physical means to go? But once you've got France, you're going to have to head down to UAE. You're going to have to head maybe to Singapore. It's just not feasible. So it's back down to this fundamental point that until there is a means of forcing and imposing regulation on these platforms and search engines, it is to a large extent a fruitless exercise. We can do ad hoc action. We can say, look, my reputation, 90% of my reputation is Ireland. Ireland's all that matters to me. Just what people think about me in Dublin. And you, if you can just get that there, I'll suck it up in terms of any other countries. That's fine. But if you're an international star, just getting your vindication in Ireland is not going to be nearly enough. Yeah.
I mean, if you compare them, say, to a motor manufacturer that has a fault in a car, if it happens in Singapore, for example, it will be withdrawn right throughout the world because that's the motor manufacturer is conscious of its own reputation and you don't want a dodgy car on the market because people won't buy it. Social media don't feel the same kind of compulsion to vindicate their own reputations.
That's a very good analogy, Pat. Have you copyrighted that? Can I take that? I'm maybe using that in the next book. But that's a very, very good analogy. And that actually highlights the problem very, very efficiently. How do you get... They keep saying... I mean, and the platforms now are around the world. Like, you know, if it's Zambia. I mean, we've had clients from most countries, certainly in North Africa, South Africa, United States, France, I mean, they will come and quite often we can take action because the big tech companies, most of them, instead of taking advantage of libel tourism, are taking advantage of tax tourism and have established a European, Middle Eastern and African headquarters in Dublin. Now, you'd have thought that's fairly straightforward. Well, that's fine. So if you've got clients from any of those three jurisdictions, they should be able to come to Dublin, to the headquarters and take action. No. Unfortunately not, because there's a snag here. Because what they quite often will do, for instance, an Egyptian media company a couple of years ago based in Cairo, and Egypt, if you Google it, you'll find that it can be either regarded as a Middle Eastern or an African country. Mm-hmm. It's normally both, but it can be one or the other.
Well, it's located in North Africa.
But that's no. Unfortunately, whenever we sign up, you probably don't know it now, but if you sign up to Facebook or you sign up to X or anything, you're actually signing up and saying, no, my data, my complaint, any complaint I have will be with the United States, our headquarters in the United States, not the European, Middle Eastern or African headquarters that are attracting this tax advantage.
Because none of us read the fine print.
Of course not. Of course, I'm a lawyer. I don't look at it. I have no idea where I've got my data, wherever, but that's a problem.
Finally, Paul, the question of costs. You were talking about the expense of litigation.
Yeah.
And it was expensive back in the day with the McGuigan-Eastwood case. Yeah. But what is your reflection on the cost today?
Well, the more complex you make legislation, the more the lawyers jump in, the more it has to be debated and argued in court, and the costs go through the roof. I was recently quoted in a case for an Irish client taking a defamation case in London. The other side's costs, defendant's costs, a figure approaching 3 million was the estimate. Because in London, you have to estimate the costs in advance. Yeah. The Wagatha Christie case you may have heard yesterday,
yeah,
the costs were about 1.8 million, I think, for Colleen Rooney. Come on. I mean, it's eye-watering. I mean, okay, it's great for us. A lawyer, I should be welcoming all this. I'm lucky in my stage of life that I don't need to work. I don't care whether people call Paul or not. You know, sometimes yeah, I please hope they don't, because you get it. But this can't, this is not sustainable. Because, I mean, apart from the fact that everyone should be entitled to access to justice, no matter what the type of case that they've got, whether it's a contract case, personal injury or defamation, this is just absurd.
On that note, the book is called From Hollywood to Hollywood, My Life as an International Libel Lawyer to the Rich and Famous. It's a hugely entertaining read, and it's author Paul Tweed. Paul, thank you very much for joining us in studio today.
Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Much, Pat.